This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, visitations and forebodings. How nightmares are used in speculative fiction.
So, this actually comes from two things. I was the one who suggested this episode. And first of all, it's because I've been having all sorts of really weird and not very pleasant dreams the last few days. And so it was on my mind. But second of all, I've just finished reading Betwixt and Between. which is Jules's latest book. And I'm going to have to take a pause here and just say, I'm in love. Oh my God, this book. It killed me. I started reading it. We went on a turtle watch with the Conservation Project out in Cyprus, and we were on the beach for like I think it was about 8 o'clock, and we were there until about 3-4 in the morning. Everyone else fell asleep, and I just sat and I read all through the night, and then I went to bed. I had like 4 hours sleep, and then I woke up and I continued reading. And I just couldn't put it down. And I really, really enjoyed it. So everyone can look forward to that.
Yay!
Very soon.
I was a bit impressed. It was like, you said, oh, I'm just going to have a look at the first bit of Betwixt and Between. I was like, oh yeah, cool. And then a couple of hours later, it was like, you were more than halfway through. I was just like, what have you been doing?
It was just there like, I'm just going to have a quick look at the beginning. And then, of course, from the moment I read the beginning, I was there like, I wonder what happens next. And before I knew it, I was halfway through. And there's something that you do in your writing that is actually quite prominent and that got me thinking, was the use of nightmares in storytelling. Yes. And how we use it to create setting and foreshadowing and all of these things. And I suddenly thought, we haven't really talked about that, and that's something that both of us do, so I really felt that we should probably have an episode all on it.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. I think some of it for me is that my perception is that when I have bad dreams, and you know, most of my dreams are at least very weird,
mm-hmm.
It's my brain trying to balance up the mental checkbook, as it were. So it makes perfect sense for me to have characters who have bizarre dreams when weird stuff is happening.
Yeah.
And but I've heard other people say, oh God, another dream sequence. It's really not about necessarily my books, but just in general, it's boring. I'm thinking, is it though? You know?
I love dream sequences. I love them, especially when they're weird. Because if you think about it, dreams are your brain's way of processing all the information, which is why you can actually have dreams which are quite prophetic. Prophetic, rather. What am I trying to say? I don't know. I'm trying to say pathetic, but I'm not. because your brain and your subconscious are processing all the information that you're getting. So you can have dreams which are actually related to what's happening, or kind of predict what's going to happen in the same way that you can predict when you're awake how courses of actions are going to go through. So, you know, your fears and your worries and things like that, they appear in your nightmares. And I really, really like it. I love writing dream sequences which are weird, which actually, if you kind of take a step back, you can say, oh, so that comes from that, and that element comes from that, and this comes from that, and you can take them all apart. And it's like a jigsaw puzzle. It's like what's the other word for puzzle? Like a riddle, but not a riddle. I'm having a moment, but yes, yeah, so, but it's basically like a riddle, and you sort of you take it apart, and you can put it back together in different ways, and it kind of really adds another element to me, and it also adds this great sense of foreboding that you always get with a nightmare, and I just think it's, you know, everything's fine, everyone's doing okay, and then someone has a nightmare, and you're like, oh, the shit is about to hit the fan.
Yes, definitely. Another criticism I've seen levelled at dream sequences is people saying that they're written too coherently. But I'm like, most of my dreams, while they're very weird, they're also very coherent. They have their own logic. And yeah. While you're in there, well, I'm in there, presumably you're not in there with me.
Or am.
Or are you? Oh, wonderful. Legion. Well, that went down a twisted path. They have their own logic. So even when I'm awake and I'm thinking, well, that's utterly nuts, I can see that under dream logic, it makes complete and perfect sense. And they are coherent. They almost have a plot. Apparently, I reject things without a plot, even when I'm asleep. My subconscious is very clear. There must be a beginning, a middle, and an end. Probably a midpoint, a point of greatest despair as well.
And an inciting incident.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't tend to have the disjointed dreams that don't make any sense, that are all sort of random stuff flung together. Either that or I perceive it differently, I don't know. So I was a bit surprised when someone said, you know, I don't have coherent dreams. And I'm like, don't you? How can you not have coherent... Anyway, sorry, that's me. That's my weird brain.
No. Some dreams I have are super coherent, and other dreams I have just are like tiny little snippets of lots of little things sewn together. And it makes sense in the dream, but you sort of look at it when you wake up and you're like, what? What? Why? But yeah, so moving away just from dreams and looking specifically at nightmares.
Yes.
We use nightmares a lot. And nightmares, I think in fiction, are specifically used for sympathy as well. Not just when we're using them for foreshadowing. But, you know, having a character who has frequent nightmares is often used to sort of create sympathy for a character. If they're having a reoccurring nightmare, we tend to sympathise with them more because everyone can understand the stress of having a nightmare.
Yeah.
Especially also because there's this lack of control that comes with nightmares. And there's also this sense of hopelessness, because actually, when you have a nightmare, you do go through all of the motions, all right? You do genuinely have fear. You will genuinely fear for your life. But at the end of the day, there's no physical harm unless you've fallen out of bed or unless, you know, you've hurt yourself in your sleep. There doesn't tend to be a physical aspect to it. So there's nothing that can really be done afterwards. You've had a nightmare, you woke up. There's a sense of relief, but there's also the sense of the fact that you've already suffered. You have suffered. And if it's reoccurring, you kind of know that you're going to suffer again.
Yeah, definitely.
And nothing can be done about it. There's literally nothing you can do about it.
Quite often, nightmares are your subconscious brain, or subconscious mind, rather, way of making you face fears that you don't actually want to face consciously.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a sort of a pylon. You know that fear, that problem is there, but you cannot physically do anything to deal with it because it's not necessarily yours to deal with. You just have to find a way of living with it, which is somehow worse. And so it just keeps coming back to you again and again and again. And if it keeps doing that and disturbing your sleep, you start to get pretty loopy.
Mm-hmm.
And your decision-making goes downhill. And it's something I did in the accidental book, Blood and Bone, because that's books, basically book four told from Kieran's perspective. And his character arc is slightly different and his focus of his story is slightly different. But he does keep having these disturbing nightmares when he's not really been one for nightmares before, and I think it does actually really affect his decision making process. So it affects how he reacts to certain events that happen, and instead of, you know, he might still have felt the same way, but I think he would have been more reasonable if he hadn't constantly had this subconscious fear being shoved in his face again and again and again.
Yeah, I think you're right. And on the other side of that, Emmeline obviously also has these nightmares at the time, which actually turn out to be more than nightmares.
Yeah, that's the thing with for her, obviously, is that she has to separate out which ones are actually the psychic nightmares that are telling her stuff and which ones are just her brain saying, yeah, you kind of need to look at this. This is something that's going to cripple you at some point in the future.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, separating the touch and her brain.
No easy task, that.
No easy task at all. No, which I do mean? Like nightmares. Sorry. Sorry, I say I like nightmares. And I like written nightmares. I don't actually like actual nightmares.
No, I mean, they're not enjoyable experience. They are things you kind of have to have, though, really, because what it all comes down to is your way of processing fear and anxiety. And yeah. I think perhaps if you haven't got your subconscious mind working on that pretty much constantly in the background and then giving you reports in the form of nightmares, then there's something very wrong with your processing ability.
Yeah. And it is part of the problem-solving brain, you know, and we've talked about this before. But if you've had a nightmare about something, you're kind of actually more prepared to deal with it when you're awake, in some respects.
Yeah.
Well, I say that, but, like, if you've had a nightmare about the zombie apocalypse, so
those aren't really nightmares. They're just kind of like recurring dreams. It's not always zombies. It's just... Okay. Ever since I was 16, I've had regular recurring dreams about the apocalypse. And we're talking sort of usually about two or three times a week, to the point where it's kind of like Alan will say, "Oh, do you sleep well?" I'm like, weird dreams. And he's like, "Did you dream about the world ending?" And I'm like, "Yeah, kind of." He's like, "So boring. Dream about something else."
My God, are you ready?
Yeah. My brain is the ultimate prepper. It's gone through every scenario possible.
I'm sticking with you. So, what if you don't mind me asking, what do you have nightmares about?
Actual nightmares?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think which ones I considered actually nightmares.
Well, I mean, for me, nightmares is just anything that sort of induces stress or fear.
I almost don't want to say this one because I feel like I'm jinxing myself, but over a year ago now, I sort of did that whole snapping awake, not really knowing where you are thing, and I dreamt my sister had died.
Ooh.
And the whole thing, it wasn't like watching like her die or anything like that. It was a case of I was at her funeral.
Yeah.
So, that was unpleasant.
That was kind of a nasty little bear trap in my brain.
As a child, I used to have nightmares about drowning, recurring nightmares about drowning.
Because you drowned in a past life?
No, because I very nearly drowned when I was 5, I think.
Oh, God.
In the sea. And I got swept out, and it was, you know, the whole thing wasn't very pleasant. I will say that anyone who's thinking of trying to breathe water, it doesn't work if you don't have gills.
Yep.
So I strongly recommend not trying that.
Can confirm.
And I just kept having, you know, I kept having dreams about being far out to sea. How I got out there, I don't know, because I didn't have a boat. And just sinking. And it would be all right to start with because there'd be all these nice bright fish and things. And then I'd suddenly realise in the dream that I couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
And after a while, I got irritated with them. So I went and learnt to swim and I didn't have them again.
It's definitely one way of solving the issue.
What's the other one? Another one I used to have as a child, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, was I used to dream that, you know, if my dad or my mum used to just need to nip into the house quickly, they quite often used to leave me in the car. And I used to dream that the car would start itself and just drive off with me in it. And there'd be no one else in the car except me strapped in the back of the car.
Oh.
And I couldn't stop it and the car would go faster and faster and faster. Just as it was about to crash, I'd wake up.
Oh, that's so scary.
And I had it over and over and over again to the point where Dad says, like, "What are you dreaming about?" And I told him and he showed me how to put the handbrake on and I've never had that dream since.
Your brain really is preparing you for stuff.
Yeah, that's what I swear. That it literally is. I have functional nightmares where it says, "No, you don't know how to deal with this situation, so we're going to bring it to your attention until you do something about this shit."
But the fact that you don't have nightmares now, because actually you've learnt to deal with everything. Every scenario, Jules knows how to deal with it.
I'm not sure about that. Mind you, my dad told me that he had he's sort of over the years had a recurring dream where he'll be in the car and it will go off a cliff or something and it'll end up in a lake or the sea and the car will be sinking. And he goes through the process in the dream of winding the window down, because I know that lets the water in, but it relieves the pressure on the door so that you can then get out and he can get basically up to the surface. And for years, my dad couldn't swim because, strange story, when he was 5, he also got swept out to sea and nearly drowned.
Jesus, Jules.
So he didn't learn until much later in life. And then dad learned to swim and he didn't have that dream again. So there you go. Apparently I've inherited this.
Incredibly functional family.
Well, so, really bizarre.
Yeah. See, I have anxiety dreams. I have busy dreams and anxiety dreams, and the anxiety dreams I consider to be nightmares. And it's always imposter syndrome, basically.
Yeah.
Where I suddenly discover, well, not that I suddenly discover, it's that the world is literally against me, in that everyone is tired of me, and they don't want to hear me, and they just have decided they don't like me. Like, my family, my friends, everybody. And no matter what I do, even if something's not my fault, I'll be put into a situation where I'll have to react and do something. And it'll just be the social death of me. And no one is on my side.
That's horrible.
I know. I have these dreams sort of fairly frequently. I had a real nightmare. It's very anxiety inducing because it was one of these dreams. And I dreamt every now and again, I'll dream about my mother quite often. But in this dream, we were arguing and she shouted at me and she was just really disappointed and angry with me and she went off and I woke up and I was in a bad mood for days. I just felt genuinely sad and really upset. And it was a dream. That's the thing. It was a dream. My mother's been dead for years, but it was just the fact that it had a really profound effect on me. And I just suddenly thought, my God. Nightmares really, really do have an effect on you. And they can affect you for a long time after the nightmare's over.
Yeah, definitely.
And I've only ever had a couple of jerk awake kind of nightmares. One was that I did dream that my mother died when she was going into recovery. I dreamt about her funeral as well. So I didn't watch her die, but I dreamt that suddenly I was at her funeral. And I woke up sobbing. And then another time, I had this very eerie feeling. I've told Jules about this, so but I'll share it with my listeners because maybe if I share him, he'll go away. I have a kind of a boogeyman person who I call him the White Face because that's all I know about him or her. I don't know what it is. All I know is it's this dark looming figure, and I only ever see them from my peripheral, and they have a white or a pale face, and that's all I know. And they just linger. Whenever I have nightmares or busy dreams, they're just there, but kind of in the background, just sort of following me.
Yeah.
And getting a little bit closer every time. And it's very menacing and it's very, very frightening. And there's this great feeling of uncanniness. And every time I think maybe I should look at him and face him, I get this real sense that if I actually look at him, it'll be the end. If I acknowledge him, if I look at him, then he can come at me. So long as I don't look at him, I'm safe from him. He'll always just be following.
Yeah.
But if I look, he can attack. So I have that. And I had this dream where I was really kind of facing him. I'm not looking at him, but he was really there. And there was all sorts of really nasty stuff going on. It was very frightening. And then all of a sudden, this hellhound jumped at me from nowhere. I turned around and this creature leapt at me, jaws wide, straight for my face. And I literally sat bolt upright in bed and just went, fuck! I was so scared. And I was exhausted as well. I'd had tests and stuff like that. And I knew that I had to get up in a few hours' time to go to uni and do stuff like that. But I was very conscious of the fact that if I went back to sleep now, I could feel this creature prowling in my subconscious. And I thought, if I go back to sleep now, he's going to get me. So I just lay awake all night, just like, oh my God, there is something waiting for me in the dreamscape. And I literally cannot go back at the moment. It is guarding the door.
Yeah, see, that's a horrible feeling as well.
Yeah. So dreams are powerful. They really, really are powerful. And nightmares in particular are very powerful. So, yeah, that's why I wanted to talk about them today. So can you think of any examples? I've got one that I would like to talk about. But can you think of any examples, Jules, of nightmares being used in speculative fiction and how they've affected the story?
Probably quite a few, actually. It is something that comes in as a literary device quite often, and obviously we both used it ourselves.
Yeah. And we'll continue to use it till the day I die.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose one of my go-to places would be Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't mention one, because I think I know which one you're going to mention. But The Stand. The Stand is, as I've mentioned before, one of my favourite books. 99% of the world's population dies off under the super flu. And then the remainder, the survivors, are drawn together by two sets of opposing dreams. And one of the sets of dreams is about the Dark Man. And the other is about Mother Abigail, who is basically the force for good. Both of these people actually exist. They're kind of prophetic dreams. And it's done really, really well in the sense of it lends that supernatural creepiness to a situation where you wouldn't expect two polarised groups of people like that. You would expect lots of little tin pot dictatorships or tribes. It sort of explains why they're drawn in those two different directions. And there's a sort of quasi-religious element to it as well. So it's something that Stephen King comes back to with, gay abandon, basically, every time. It's in several of his books. I've just read The Outsider, which is a really interesting one. It's his new book. And once again, dreams do play a part, but you're constantly thinking, are these dreams actually real? Or how much of the dream is real? How much of it's dream? How much of it is this outsider invading that person's dreamscape in order to manipulate them? Because there isn't a lot of physical evidence for this thing to have actually happened, and yet it's the very coherence of these dreams and the fact that people are sharing them in that way suggests that they're more real than just mere phantasms of the mind, as it were. And it's really deliciously creepy, shall we say.
Yeah. I think I probably have to, and I don't know whether I should mention this, so yeah, I'm gonna name the title. So The Pet Cemetery. Anyone who plans on reading The Pet Cemetery, you might want to just ignore this next little bit. There's this great bit in The Pet Cemetery where there is a tragedy. And the main character dreams that he managed to avoid the tragedy. He managed to save the person who was killed. And the way that King writes it, he makes it feel like the tragedy itself was the nightmare. And it was prophetic. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
It was a prophetic nightmare that warned the main character what was going to happen, and ultimately then he was able to save this person. And then you kind of jerk out of it and you realise, no, the tragedy did happen. And the nightmare was actually the bit where he thought that he managed to save this person. And it's really uncanny, and I like the way he does that, because actually I think the worst dreams for me are the ones where I suddenly think, this is reality. And because usually for me I'm able to say, no, hold on a second, this is a dream, and that's how I'm able to kind of step away from things. Yeah. But every now and again I'll go, this is a dream, and then I'll go, oh my god, no, this is real. This is actually real, and I have to deal with this. And it's really scary, actually, when you've had a good dream and then you wake up and you realise that it wasn't real. and that there was a tragedy and that you have to deal with it. And that can happen when you're awake as well. When my grandfather died, I was in this haze trying to get everything together so I could fly over for his funeral. And I was so tired. And I was there, I was brushing my teeth, and I suddenly went, oh, thank God, this is just a dream. I realize I'm having a nightmare.
Yeah.
And then I went, no, this is real. And then, like, 5 minutes later, I went, no, thank God, no, this is just a nightmare. None of this is real. And then I had to go, no way, I am definitely awake. And it's really discombobulating, and it's really scary. And I've seen a few examples of that used, and Stephen King's The Pet Sematary is probably one of the finest examples of that really kind of disjointed dreaming, which makes you feel, it's like your stomach does a flip. You don't know what's happening. You can't grasp reality for a second. And I think that the tragedy is made worse by that element of hope, which was that actually, it's not happened. It's been prevented. Because often we do have a common structure that we see, is we see an accident happen, and then it goes whoop 24 hours before, and then we see it, the kind of the precursor to that accident happening, and then you realise it's actually about perspective. And yeah. The accident doesn't happen, they've managed to avoid it or stuff like that, so no one's really dead, or it was a setup or something like that. We're very used to that kind of thing. So if you have that element of tragedy, then a dream where everything was fine, it really does set you up to believe, okay, so that was just a prophetic dream, which happens. So that really, that was a curveball for me. I've really, really enjoyed that book. Definitely worth reading. Another fine example of the use of nightmares for me, which really got under my skin, was actually in the TV series Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
Now, I can't remember which series it was, maybe four, three, four. The characters have all been through something very traumatic, which has kind of opened the door in their minds to some bad things, and all of them begin to have sort of, some begin to hallucinate, and one begins to feel like he's losing control of his powers and stuff like that. And one character, Styles, goes through this uncomfortable thing where he doesn't know when he's awake and when he's asleep.
Yeah.
And he and the way they did it was fantastic. There's just this sequence where you see him going through the motions of having these weird and really rather unpleasant dreams. And you can see it's really sort of wearing down on him. And the next day he goes to school and he's talking to his best friend, Scott. And he's just saying, yeah, I'm really, really struggling with this. I think something's wrong. And then he turns to Scott, he says, you know, the worst part is that I don't know whether I'm awake or asleep. And then it clicks, and him sits up in bed screaming, because that entire day, it was a dream.
Yeah.
And it was just so, I'd never seen it done like that. I'd never seen a nightmare which was mundane, but was therefore scary because it was mundane. I just thought it was fantastic. And I thought that was a really clever way of creating this nightmarish hellscape, by just really giving the impression that there is no escape from it. There literally is no escape.
Yeah, and that sort of, for me personally, hits a bit close to home. Because with my temporal lobe epilepsy, what I've said before, it alters your perception of reality. So without medication, that is literally what my life looks like.
Oh, Christ, Jules.
And you go through phase, in one of the facets of temporal lobe epilepsy is it doesn't let you sleep. And it's always made worse by not being rested.
Yeah.
And your brain basically wakes you up every few minutes when you think you're having a full night's sleep and you're not. So your brain is constantly exhausted. It's constantly pumping out all these chemicals. It's constantly slightly off. And reality is always slightly off. And sometimes it gets pretty darn peculiar, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So that sort of am I awake, am I asleep thing is almost a permanent feature when it's particularly bad. So yeah, I haven't seen it done in a lot of books and films like that, but I have experienced it firsthand.
Yeah. So that is that's one that actually we're seeing a little bit more of, because there is this general fear, because I think it's about, it feeds into our fear of the lack of control, and it takes it to the next step, the idea that one cannot escape a nightmare.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, we have a lot of mythos when it comes to nightmares. The nightmare, as in the mare, appears in different forms across the world, and we have dream creatures everywhere. In particular, we have the hag, and this is tied in with sleep paralysis.
Yeah,
which is another level of nightmarish instances. Do you want to talk a little bit about the hag, Jules?
I can do, and I mean, go from the position of saying nightmare. I mean, as you say, that's where it originally comes from. It was a supposedly horse-like creature, and they'd say, "Oh, the mare's been riding you," and usually that meant you'd been having. Sometimes it meant you'd been having sexual dreams. And sometimes it meant you'd been having really terrible sort of nightmares and things, and sometimes the two were the same thing, as in intensely sexual dreams that are actually terrifying.
Yeah.
So that's where the nightmare comes from. It's also connected to the Mari Clwyd, which is the white mare of death that appears at Halloween in Wales.
Yes.
We won't go into that, we've mentioned it before. But you know, old hag syndrome, sometimes called hypnagogic hallucination, where you believe you're awake but actually you're asleep, and you're just awake enough to consider the matter but not awake enough to have any muscular control.
Yeah.
And it feels like this great weight pressing down on you, or as if something sat on your chest. And a lot of people report seeing a dark figure at the end of the bed, or sat on the bed, or sometimes sat on them, terrifyingly enough.
Yeah.
That all goes with it. And the only way to break out of it is to actually be able to move slightly, and then that shatters the illusion.
Yeah.
So that's where the sort of myth and legend comes from. But it's such a common one right across, you know, all cultures, in fact.
It is. In fact, I've got a list here from all sorts of countries. And it is strange, but for the large part, it does tend to be a female figure.
Yeah.
So you have the Filipino Tagalog, Bangungot, which literally translates to rise and moan during sleep. And apparently this was a malevolent spirit that lives in trees, and when trees are cut down and used to make things, this spirit will still live inside of the constructed materials, basically. And they look like ugly, obese women, and they will infest houses, and they will sit on their victim's chest and face to push their life force out. So we've got that. We've got the Dabsog, which is, I think, fed into the Freddy Krueger kind of mythos. And once again, smothering victims sitting on their chests. Apparently they look like a furry American stuffed animal, but with prominent claws and teeth. So
fun.
One I've been looking at recently is the Baku. Now, interesting enough, the Baku is one of the only few in the list which is a little bit different. And this is, it's a Japanese yokai. And the Baku is actually kind of not benevolent, but the Baku eats dreams and nightmares. So if you've had a nightmare, you can call upon the Baku to eat the nightmare away and protect you. But you should be wary of doing it too often, because if you do, the Baku may very well come forward and eat your hopes and motivation along with your dreams. So, you know, don't do that too long. You've got the Lyderic, obviously the Mare, the Alp, the Hag, the Djinn as well, if we go in towards the Quran and the Islamic versions. Nokhnitsa, a Russian one, Pezanta, from Spain, the Domovoy, the Truco. They're pretty much all the same. And actually, oddly enough, the Pezanta is one of the few, other than the Baku and the Dab Tsog. I'm probably saying all of these wrong, except for Baku. I'm definitely saying Baku, right? it's one of the few I can say right. Yeah, the Pezanta is a little bit different because it isn't humanoid. And in fact, it looks more like a beast, so either a cat or a dog. And the description is, along with its bestial nature, it has like steel paws with holes, so it can touch but cannot take objects from the waking world. And it just sounds rather unpleasant, to be honest.
It does. I'm going to go a bit off the wall here and mention aliens.
Let's talk about aliens.
and no doubt that will lead to an F word for you. A lot of reported, I won't say alien abductions, but alien encounters, as they are. Mm-hmm. I'm not coming down on one side or the other. Mm-hmm. Some of it sounds unlikely to me, or it sounds like a particular perception on a collective group of experiences that someone has interpreted in that way, because that's the way they're wired.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the whole sort of reported, oh, you know, the aliens came for me type thing, actually has a lot in common with all of these ongoing myths and legends. You know, the idea of the sleep paralysis, or something pressing down on you, not being able to breathe, a figure standing over you, or figures standing over you. Sometimes even the bright lights as well.
Yeah. It does. I remember hearing an abduction story, or rather it was an attempted abduction. And again, it was a something at the end of the bed. And I don't know whether you've had that experience, but for me, it feels fairly universal that we've all kind of actually woken up and thought there's something at the end of the bed.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Especially from the sort of disturbed sleep. Or that there's something looming nearby. God, the looming. The looming's the worst.
Yes.
Like, either be here or don't. But yes, you have the alien abductions. And now, time to put a little penny in the F jar, but fairies have a lot to do with sleep as well. As fairies have a lot to do with everything, they pretty much cover all courses of life. But we also have things like the succubus and the incubi.
Yes.
Who are again related to sleep. And I think rather than nightmares, sometimes it was related to nightmares. But more often than not, it was related to sexy dreams. Sexy dreams and sleep paralysis. And also unexplained pregnancies. Unexplained.
For those who don't know what an incubus or a succubus is, incubus male, succubus female, they come in and find poor, unsuspecting, innocent people while they're asleep and have sex with them while they're asleep.
And impregnate, sometimes. Except for the men. The idea is that they do it because demons and fairies cannot actually produce their own offspring, so they need, or it's very difficult for them to produce their own offspring, so they kind of need to sort of take from the human line a little bit every now and again.
Yeah.
To basically breed, so they use humans to breed. Kind of like Alien.
Yep, once again you have those, I won't say themes, I don't know if folklore has themes, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The same tropes.
Yeah. Well. The same kind of, the mythos that extends around. It is really interesting. I mean, just the way sleep is used in general. I'm going on a slight tangent here, but just sleep is interesting, if you think about it. It's a very peculiar thing that we all do.
Yeah, definitely.
Where we literally go, right, it's the ritual behind it as well. It's like, I'm going to get into my special clothes. go to my special little nest.
Close my eyes.
Close my eyes and go into a pretend sleep. And if I don't do it for 8 hours, I'm going to be grumpy. Actually a really weird thing if you think about it.
In that respect, yes, it is kind of, obviously it's absolutely necessary, and some very weird stuff starts to happen to you if you go a certain amount of time without sleep.
Yeah, do not recommend not sleeping. Sleeping is incredibly good for you. Which is again why I think nightmares have such an impact, because you don't actually understand how necessary sleep is until you've stopped being able to sleep.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And it's just as vital as water and food. Okay, being deprived of sleep is a form of torture.
Yes,
it literally is used as a form of torture. So having nightmares and having those kinds of dreams is a form of torture. So it does actually have a physical effect on you. It will affect your decision-making, and we've talked about this with Kieran, obviously, but it will affect your decision-making, it will affect your mood, it will affect your, on a biological scale, it will have an effect on your immune system and your general health. You're more likely to get things like headaches, you're more likely to feel achy and tired, you're more likely to get sick, and on an emotional scale, you're more likely to be at peril of your own emotions. So you're more likely to overreact to things, you're more likely to feel things more keenly, to be irritable, and to make poor decisions.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So there you go. Sleep, people.
At least 5 hours if you're me.
Oh, Jules.
Oh, well. Sleep is not a friend of mine.
No.
Which probably explains my writing, really.
It's odd because I used to, my average was about sort of 4 to 6, usually about 5 hours a night when I was younger. And that's all I would manage. And now I will sleep solid. I say I sleep solid. I don't sleep solid. I toss and turn and wake up a lot. But I will get, you know, about 8 hours. And I just don't understand how I used to function. How I functioned on only 5 hours of sleep. I don't understand it now. Whenever I'm healthy, I'm like, how did I live? How could I live like this?
Trying not to begrudge you that right now. So.
I'm sorry, Jules. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week.
Yeah.
And I know it's not out yet. I know it's not out yet, and you're all going to have to wait, but my God, you will have to read Betwixt and Between.
You didn't tell me you were going to do that.
No, I didn't tell you. I purposefully didn't tell you. Because you'd have suggested something else. Yes. But I'm putting it out there. You have to read Betwixt and Between. I absolutely loved it. Just the levels of mythos, the characters, the writing. I tell you what, it's no one else really kind of reels me in with that strange uncanniness in the same way that you do, Jules. I'm enchanted. I love it. So that has to go on everybody's reading lists. I'm just putting it out there. Betwixt and Between, you can all look forward to it. I really want my paperback copy now.
Thank you very much. I mean, it was a complete accident. It was supposed to be a 20,000 word novella.
Yeah, but Jules. And Jules was like, I'm writing a novella. And I'm like, no, you're not. She was like, yeah, it's just going to be a novella. I'm like, it's going to be a book. And you were adamant. You said I was wrong, but I was not wrong.
It's like 40,000 words. It's like, yeah, I can have up to 50. It's like, really?
It was the fact you're like, okay, so it's gone over a little bit. And I'm like, so it's going to be a book. And you were like, no, it's still going to be a novella. And lo and behold, it's another novel.
It was a book. Anyway, yes, so that will be coming out, I don't know, probably end of August, I think. I will put out dates soon.
Very cool. All right. And on that note, guys, We'll catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.